All right. The reason why we're all here tonight is this man right here, Peter B. from Santa Maria. Let's welcome him up.
Peter, alcoholic. We have five newcomers in the room tonight. And I think the best thing I can say to you tonight is your best days of your life lay ahead of you. You know, you gotta just do the work to get there. Let's see. I started Al-Anon before I started AA. My Al-Anon birthday is September 17th, 1984. My sober date is January 25th, 1987. I was born in La Mesa, California, which is about 26 miles east of San Diego. And my dad owned a bar. My uncles owned bars. My grandfather was a winemaker. I remember the first time I ever met a non-drinker, I was 14 years old. And I thought, they must really be odd. I mean, I just assumed everybody in the world drank. It was just weird to meet somebody who didn't drink. And it was a typical alcoholic home, lots of violence, lots of yelling, lots of nobody knows what's going on, and why are things happening, and why did they happen, and, you know, all that stuff. And graduated from one alcoholic family into another when I joined the United States Navy, and there was no consequences about drinking, which is really odd, because my sponsor, who got sober in the Marine Corps in 1971, the year I got out of the Navy, he got sober because the Marines didn't want to put up with his drinking, you know? And it's like, it really changed, I guess, because there was none of that when I was in the Navy. It was just, you know, do what you needed to do and get drunk. And so I got out of the Navy, and I have this problem, and it rose its head today, but I've always done this. And normal people, if they want to do something, you know, like a career, they go talk to the people that are doing that career to see if maybe that's a good idea, something they would like to do. I've never done that, ever, you know. I decided to move today at noon, and I had a new place to live by 3, and I'm moving in on August 1st. I mean, it's just like, oh, let's go do that, you know? I don't research stuff, I just do it, you know? And what happened is I was sitting in our break room aboard ship, and I had 30 days until I get out of the Navy, and I'm flipping through a copy of Modern Photography, and there's a little ad, and it's for a photography school in Santa Barbara called Brooks. And so I sent off a postcard. They sent me this form. I didn't know anything about it. I asked the guys I worked with, what about this? What about, we filled it out together, mailed it in. I had the GI Bill. They accepted me. You know? I mean, I bought a camera in Japan. You know, why not go to Fogger Photography School? You know? So I went to photography school for 2 months. And I discovered that I didn't like working in the darkroom, because I had worked on a flight deck for 4 years. And you know, working on a flight deck, things get busy and crazy and explosive and hot and all that stuff. And that's the kind of family I grew up in. I liked that adrenaline back in those days. So standing in a darkroom, you know, souping negatives, didn't fire my desire, so I quit. And there it comes again. This, like, I'm laying in bed, October of 71, and wake up. I'll become a firefighter. Okay, that sounds like a good idea. So I went to Santa Barbara City College for 2 years, got an associate's degree in fire science, and moved to San Diego and became an aircraft crash and structural firefighter for 4 years. Meantime, you know, for the hell of it, I took some PE classes and I took a tennis class, and I met this young woman that I just madly fell in love with. And she was living in a crazy family. Mom was addicted to benzodiazepines, and she wanted out. So when I said I was moving to San Diego, she goes, can I go? I go, absolutely. You know? So we moved to San Diego, and you know, I just madly loved the woman. Always, to this day, you know? And you know, I went down, got a job at NAS North Island. She got a job as a physical therapy aide, because she didn't know if she wanted to be a physical therapist or an occupational therapist. So she was bouncing back and forth between those two. And so, you know, we bought a house, we got married, we had two cats. You know, we're middle class. We're there. I got a career position with the United States government, you know. And so she comes to me and says, I want to become an occupational therapist. I go, okay. She goes, well, there's only one state school that offers that, and that's in San Jose. I said, okay. You know, I had lived my life, my dream, you know. I'd done firefighting for 4 years. And I loved her, you know. And I'm willing to sacrifice things for individuals that I love, both male and female. And so I quit my job. We sold our house. We moved to San Jose. And went back to school. That's where she became an occupational therapist. I got my bachelor's and master's there. And she came up to me and said, you know, we moved to San Jose for me, you know. Like we told, you know, you tore your life up, Peter, for me to live my dream. I go, that's true. She goes, so any place you want to move, when we're done here, we can go, you know. And so we researched. I said, the Pacific Northwest, that's where I want to go. So we researched Portland, Seattle, Spokane, and Boise, and decided on Boise. And so there again, you know, I'm the guy, you know, go visit the place, ask questions. No, let's just pack our crap and go, you know. That's me, you know. It's like, hey, sounds like a good idea. And so, but she wasn't like that. She's like, no, I want to go up and research this place. So we drove up. It was, you know, there's things I remember in my mind about her, you know, faces and times. And this, we're driving down, and Boise has a river that runs through it. And it was July. We went up to check it out, July of 1980. And, but I guess she didn't put it together that there was a river in the middle of town. And we're driving across the bridge, and there's people tubing coming down the river. And she's looking at that, and she looks at me, you know, with that innocent little girl look of, there's a river in town, you know. I go, and it's one of those warm little feelings that I can nurture myself with to this day, you know. And so, you know, we went to a rehab hospital. They hired her on the spot because there's no OT school in the state, you know. And I was working Santa Clara County Health Department at the time. I had a contract to finish up until May. So we moved her up in January of 81, and then I worked in San Jose until May of that year, and then I moved up. And so we bought aluminum can with wheels on it called a mobile home in 1977 for $8,000 in San Jose. We turned around and sold it for $29,000 4 years later. You know, we're rolling in bucks. You know, we have arrived, baby. You know, I mean, she's working, I'm working, we got money, bought a new car, bought a house on the north end, you know, beautiful old, what they call a Tudor, you know, and, you know, 100-foot trees in the front yard, wild squirrels, all that. I remember sitting on the front porch with her, and we liked camping, we did a lot of backpacking, and we're sitting on the front porch, and I turned to her, I go, you think we should go camping? And she turns to me, and she goes, we are camping, you know. And because being from Southern California, Boise is camping, you know. And so, you know, and so it was, if we wanted to have kids, it was time to have kids. So we got pregnant December 12th, I think. I remember the actual day, and we got pregnant. Yeah. And I got weird. To this day, I wish I could relive those, that 6-8 months that we had together. because all my stuff came up about being a dad, and I had a terrible relationship with my dad. I did not want to be my dad. I was scared as hell I was going to be my dad, and I couldn't talk about any of that. I mean, I didn't have 12 steps. I didn't have a sponsor. I wasn't sober. You know, I didn't know. And she knew there was something wrong with me, but she didn't talk much either. So we just, like, we're doing this dance about, you know, well, you're pregnant, you know, but the kid's not here yet, you know. So it was 4th of July of 82, and she loved fireworks, just loved fireworks. And so that happened to fall on a Sunday, and the actual celebration was the following Monday, the 5th. So we had a Toyota truck with a shell on it, and we would throw redwood patio furniture, two seats, in the back of the truck, a hibachi, some beer, and we would go like to the drive-in movie and park backwards and pull all this stuff out so we could watch the movie. Well, this time we went to did all that going to see fireworks. So we pulled it out, set it up, we had dinner, and fireworks didn't start until about 9. We had dinner like 6:30, and you know, the problem with trauma is when you go through that process, here it is, it's 37 years later, and I can bring back memories of that night. Those the next 48 hours, I can remember like what it smelled like, what I was doing, the words I was, what I was writing down. I mean, just all that stuff. And I remember the first burst went off, and I turned to look at her in her seat, and she wasn't there. And when she wasn't there, I had this cold feeling go down my spine. Like, there is something significantly wrong here, because she wouldn't miss fireworks. So I got up and I walked over to the truck, and she's in the front of the truck, and I'm going, what's going on? She goes, I got a stomach ache really bad. And I said, is it the kid? And it's like, no, you know, I just have a really strong stomach ache. I'm going, do you want to leave? No. Okay. So I kept going back and forth to her while this was going on, because my attention's on her, not on the fireworks. And she wanted to finish the fireworks. And it's like, okay. So we get in the car and we start driving. And we're halfway home. She goes, I want to go to the hospital. I'm going, okay, go to the hospital. So we go to the hospital. We walk in. We both walk into the ER. She presents with a really severe stomach ache. They give her a shot of Demerol. We had had steak that night. She had set up in the ER. She looked at me and she says, that's the last time I'm going to eat meat. And she laid back down, and drool started to come out of her side of her mouth. And the doctor lifted her eyelids, and both eyes were at pinpoints. And I knew what that meant, you know. And that's when they turned to me and said, you got to leave. And so I left. They had tied her arms and her legs down to the gurney, because when you have that stroke, you know, you start to jerk. And I'm like, you know, where are we going with this? And so they moved her ICU. I went upstairs to the ICU. And all I wanted to do was go home. It's all I wanted to do, go home. For those first 3 hours, you know, I said, you know, I don't like this game, Gail. I want to go home. Let's go home. You know, we got the cats at home. We got a life at home. I want to go home, you know. She had really fine fingers. I mean, she was an occupational therapist. She was into tatting and macrame and batik and all that stuff. And what, at 3 o'clock in the morning, her fingers started to swell. And that was a sign to me that this was real. And that's when I lost it. It was like, this is, you know, my life's coming to an end. You know, I'm never, all those plans we had, out the window in a blink of an eye. So at 6 o'clock in the morning, her OBGYN comes in and goes, we're having a baby. I go, okay. So we took my son cesarean 6 hours after she had the stroke. And of course, I'm calling family. I started calling family like right after she had the stroke. In fact, they told me, I mean, that's a revelation I had, you know, in the last year. We walked into the hospital 11:30 at night, and an hour later at 12:30, I got doctors saying to me, you better start calling family because she's not going to survive, you know, within an hour, you know. So I'm calling family. I'm 1,000 miles away from family, you know. Nobody's there. It's July 4th weekend. There's nobody in the hospital. There's no pastor. There's no social workers. There's nothing. And I start calling people that my wife knew at work, and they started coming down, you know, just because I don't know what to do, you know. And there is nothing I can do, you know. That's all I wanted. I just want to fix this. I've always been a fixer, you know. And you can't fix it, you know. Here it goes. And so family showed up at 3 o'clock the next afternoon. And then she died the following morning. And my life changed forever, you know, to this day, you know. And that's the problem with my son's cerebral palsy. It is a marker of that night. I mean, I think I could have done better with life if he hadn't had cerebral palsy, because it'll always be a marker of that night. If he had just been a normal kid, and we could have just had a normal life. And it's like, and I went to a widower's group, and everybody there was over 75 except me. And they came up and said, are you the guest speaker tonight? And I said, no, you know, I'm a widower, you know. And they're like, really? And, you know, and, you know, alcoholics love to be unique. It was way too unique for me. It was like, you know, I just wanted normalcy. You know, I wanted to have a normal kid. I wanted to have a normal life. I wanted to have a normal wife, you know. And so, you know, family came up. They were with me. My son was in NICU for a month and a half. I was working still and flying around the West. I was working for Boise Interagency Fire Center on a flight crew. And, you know, I mean, everybody was showing up, they were doing stuff, but it was like, you know, my whole life over the last 10 years have been her and me putting together this plan of life, and as we're moving through. And in the snap of a finger, it's over. It's over, you know. And there's no negotiation, you know. So I started just meandering, you know. I felt like what I really needed was a woman in my life. I had some real disaster stuff going on right after she died, probably for the first year or two. And then I had a friend who was a counselor at the Booth Memorial Home, Salvation Army. Booth is the guy who started Salvation Army. Booth Memorial Home was for teenage women, girls who were pregnant. And she went to a workshop on adult children of alcoholics. She came by and showed me like all the behaviors we do and all that stuff. And I'm reading that list. I'm going, that's me. That's my sister. That's me. That's my sister. And I'm going, this is good stuff. And there was one Al-Anon meeting a week in Boise that was adult children. And I went there. It was a Monday night. I remember walking up the stairs. I remember that. The room was about 3/4 the size of this room, and the chairs all around the perimeter. We sat down, and people started sharing their experience of growing up in an alcoholic home, and I identified. I was home. I had found my people, you know, because, you know, I had gone to church. I didn't fit. I didn't fit in church. It was like, you don't understand, you know, there is no answer here for me. I wasn't ready for church, you know. I needed some real basic bottom line, you know, AA stuff, you know. I needed people to love me, and that's what you people did. So, you know, I'm in, and I'm going to Al-Anon. I'm going to one Al-Anon a week, and they're talking about that God stuff, you know, and it's like, when I got here, all I could do was put the F word in front of God. I'd been screwed. I had done everything right. I'd served my country. I'd spent 660 days in Vietnam. You know, I'd gone to school. I had 3 college degrees. I owned a house. I'd done all the right things. I loved my wife. I took care of her. I paid my bills. I filled out my tax forms. I did everything right, and I'm screwed. And so I was angry with God and angry with my father and angry being a guy and angry that my son had cerebral palsy. And, and Jana Cardoza said, can you have an imaginary friend you talk to? And I said, yeah, I can have an imaginary friend I talk to. So I started talking to this imaginary friend. And after about a month, I needed a name for this imaginary friend, so I named him George. When I got sober, my first sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous was named George. That's right. And I was with George yesterday. Yeah, he moved to Seattle when I moved here, and then he moved down here about a year ago. So it's really neat spending time with, you know, like blasts from the past, you know. And so I went to work in treatment because I was an Al-Anon. Somebody wanted to do weekends. You know how hard it is to work in alcohol and drug treatment when you're working, you know, Monday through Friday in treatment, and Friday and Saturday night you're drinking? And that's like having 1 foot on the gas pedal and 1 foot on the brake. You know, it's just the cognitive dissonance, they call it, you know. And I remember this. I'm looking at this bottle of wine I'm drinking. I only wanted to drink half the bottle of wine, and I knew I was going to drink it all. And when it was done, I knew I was going to go get another one. I knew I couldn't stop, you know. And I'd been around Al-Anon long enough to know about the disease and all that, and it's like, me too, you know. That's the most important 2 words in Alcoholics Anonymous is me too. So I started going to AA meetings. And I started identifying and all that kind of stuff. And that's when I met George. And I'd go over and see George, and his front door was not locked. We did not have an Alano Club at that time in Boise. And if you needed some place to be safe and sober, you could go to George's house and sleep on his couch. You know? And everybody got a handshake or a hug, except me. When I walked in, he'd look at me and he'd go, don't you have a son in California? And I go, yeah. And he would say, what the hell are you doing here? Get the hell out of here. Your son needs you. You know, so I got sober in January of 87, and I left Boise in May of 88. You know? And this was not going to be a fun reunion. I knew it. In-laws didn't like me. I didn't like them. Grandma was an addict. I'm an alcoholic. And Grandpa is an enabler, you know. And Grandpa especially didn't like me because I slept with his daughter without the benefit of marriage. And I think he hated me about that until the day he died in my household, you know. So, you know, thank God I was in AA, you know. Living, you know, trying, doing homework with my son, bathing. But the laughter. My son is built like my wife, but he has my brain. And we really connected on that level. And we were talking this morning on the phone. He calls me 3-4 times a week about stuff. But what really connected us was our humor. Because I used to bathe him. So he'd be in the bathtub. And I would take him out of the bathtub. I had blankets on the bed, and I would carry him to the bed, and then we would dry him off on the bed. Well, he has what's called a startle response. Babies have that startle response. His never went away, and he can never predict when it's going to happen. Okay, and so he'd be this wet fish in my arms between the bathroom and the bedroom, and he'd have a startle response, and he'd start flopping around in my arms, and I'd start laughing, and he'd start laughing, and here we go, you know? And those are the kind of things that saved my life, you know? And so, you know, I got married twice in recovery, I got divorced twice in recovery, and I, You know, we live life forward, we understand it backwards. And what I understand today is I had to be a quality man to have a quality woman in my life. That's the deal, okay? You can't be a hound dog and around here and expect that you're gonna run into a partner who is quality. If you're not quality, they're not gonna be quality. And that's what happened to me. And I didn't understand that until I became a Christian. Oh my God. Yes, I became a Christian 3 years ago. Oh yeah, here we go. You know, well, I hate to tell you, read page 96, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. Conference approved material. Okay, Dr. Bob talking in Detroit, November 1949, his last talk to AA before he died in 1950. He said, you know, in the beginning, our stories didn't amount to much. We didn't have the 12 steps. And what we found absolutely essential to stay sober was Sermon on the Mount, 1 Corinthians 13, and the book of James. And I'll tell you, you read the book of James is only 3 to 5 pages long, depending on which one you read. James chapter 2, verse 20. Faith without works is dead. When you walk into Dr. Bob's house in Akron, Ohio at 855 Ardmore Street, what is in the front room in plastic is Ann Smith's Bible open to the book of James. Okay? But I'm kind of getting ahead of myself there because Al-Anon helped me put together the craziness of my childhood and started how to fix that. Alcoholics Anonymous got me to the point that I could accept the fact that I had to return to California and be a father. That's what they did. What Christianity did for me is had me take a look at my inappropriate behavior around women. Okay, and that's that process that I've gone through. And today, I have a woman friend. She doesn't like being called girlfriend because it's too exclusive. But I met her in the Pacific Region Forum last September. And she has a lot of loss in her life. When she told me about all that, I said, well, I want to get to know her. Because loss attracts loss. You know, I mean, it's... You know, it's like, I love that one sticker of Vietnam veterans. It says, if you haven't been there, shut the fuck up. You know? You know? It's like, if you haven't had that experience, don't talk about it. You know? And so, she has been really significant because she became a Christian when she was 15. And she knows her stuff. And, you know, I mean, I'm just talking about AA stuff, and all of a sudden, we're off into scripture, you know? And then we drift back into AA stuff, and then we're back into scripture, and we're back and forth. And it's like, this is neat. You know? So, and that's what I want to talk about today, you know? I've told my story. That's how I got here. But I want to talk about steps 6 and 7. So, they're the, what they call the forgotten steps. And I couldn't, you know, there's a lot of depth in 6 and 7. I've come to a conclusion because what I heard was Bill used the 4 absolutes of the Oxford group in step 6 and 7. The 4 absolutes are honesty, unselfishness, love, and purity. Okay, absolute purity. Okay, well, you're pushing my buttons around moral issues when you're talking about purity. So I looked it up in the dictionary. You know what it means? Clarity. Has nothing to do with morality. It will as you go down the definitions, but the first definition is clarity. So, okay, so I revolted against absolutes. Just like everybody else in this room, okay? The difference between us and the Oxford group is you had to have a spiritual surrender before you joined Oxford group. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't care. Come on in, you know? You'll get around to that, you know? Okay, so how do you work 6 and 7 in the absolutes? Well, what my friend Janice talked about was those absolutes are God. That's not us. God has those absolutes. God is absolute honesty, unselfishness, purity, and love. That's God. I don't have to measure myself at that level. God measures himself at that level. It's like, oh, you're supposed to be a screwed up person. That's why Ernie Kurtz titled his book, Not God, because that is the focus of Alcoholics Anonymous, of us getting to the point that we're not God. Ernie Kurtz was a Jesuit priest who went back to Harvard to get his PhD in American history. And for his PhD dissertation, he wrote the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they published it as a book called Not God. And the first half of the book is great stuff. You know, I mean, it really, I mean, if you're an AA history nut like I am, you really revel in that stuff, you know? And it's like, this is great stuff. The last half is all research. If you're a research bug about Dr. Bob wore horizontally striped purple socks on days he did surgery for good luck. What was Dr. Bob's favorite dessert? Boston cream pie. Those are the kinds of things you can find out from Kurtz. Great stuff. I encourage everybody in the room to pick up that book and read it. You'll love it. You know? But then we get into soul and spirit. And I always thought the two are the same, and they're not. We talk about we have a soul sickness. And how we define soul is mind, emotion, and will. And spirit is intuition, communion, and conscience. And when you start looking at the drugs and alcohol effect on intuition, communion, and conscience, you can see why we can't get in touch with our spirit when we're loaded. It's not there. We can't get there from here. You know, I had this intuition experience. I'm a hospice volunteer because I've had so much experience with death. It's like I just love being with the family dealing with this, because really what's happening is the person who's passing away is pretty much okay with where they're going. They're in that process. It's the family that's going nuts. You know, we got a house payment, we got a car payment, we got kids in college, you know, we got all this stuff. We weren't planning on him or her passing away. And, you know, God gave me two ears and one mouth for a reason. I tend to listen a lot when I'm a hospice volunteer. But what happened, I had this couple, they were Jewish from Chicago. They had been married 63 years, and he's dying of Parkinson's. And so he's gone into what my friend Janice says, waiting on the Lord, which is a coma. They're in a coma. They're basically waiting to pass. And so a niece had flown out from New Jersey to say goodbye. And the room that we were in, it was a square room with a partition. And then Mel, the guy that's passing, is in bed on this side of the partition. And then his wife, me, and this his daughter-in-law and the niece from New Jersey were in this room. So I've been there about 2 hours and I'm leaving. And as I stand up, God says, say goodbye to Mel. I have this intuition. Of course, my brain goes, well, you're saying goodbye to Mel because next time you're going to see Mel, he's probably going to be dead, you know? And so I walked around and guess what? Mel is awake, you know? And I go, hi, Mel. How are you doing? You know? And as soon as the three women hear me talking to Mel, they come around. And so they had a chance to say goodbye to Mel before he passed, because I had that intuitive sense to say, I need to talk to Mel before I leave, you know? And I really encourage you, take a look at those three, intuition, communion, and conscience, because that's our spirit. And our soul is mind, emotion, and will. You know, and my friend Janice, she'll say, you're talking emotion to me. I don't want to hear emotion. You know, she has this saying, that's a pie in the sky. I want steak on the plate. you know. Let's talk about this, you know. And yeah, she keeps me real honest. I mean, it's amazing. Whew. So, where am I today? I am your DCM. What the hell is DCM? District Committee Member, okay? For you new people, you're five newcomers, okay? Alcoholics Anonymous, our general service, you know, where you have a pyramid and the boss is at top and the workers are at the bottom. We take that pyramid, we turn it upside down, okay? World Service in New York works for us. They are their employee. Whenever they come out to see us, they always dress in a suit because they say, I'm coming to see my boss, okay? And how we communicate to them about our issues, if we have a group service representative, a GSR. My job is to herd GSRs to area events. Yeah, sort of like spiders. And so, there's some good stuff coming up right now. Jeff was just talking about me, a new pamphlet that came out for mentally ill and sponsoring mentally ill. We got one that has been in England for a long time. God talked about the God word, and that just came up. There's lots of stuff going on. Next year, in about a year, July 1st, 2nd, 3rd, we're having our fifth, every 5 years, we have an international convention. And next year it's in Detroit. 6 years from now, it'll be in Vancouver, British Columbia. And then 11 years from now, it'll be in St. Louis. And what happened is I said, okay, God, I want to be alive on June 10th, 2035. That is AA's 100th birthday. And God says, lose weight. Go to the YMCA. I said, can't you just remove the weight? And he goes, nope, can't do that. You know, I had a friend who was a doctor. He says, you know, I got sober. I wanted to become a doctor. I asked God if I could go become a doctor. And God said, go to medical school. You know? So, I really encourage you guys, you know, start planning on that. If you can't go next year, 6 years from now, you can jump on the Coast Starlight and it'll take you to Vancouver. But I hope to be in Akron on January 10th, 2035. Got to lose weight. Do that stuff. Let's see. Talk about 6 and 7. It's been a hell of a ride. Hell of a ride. And I've stayed sober through most of it. I mean, I'm coming up on almost half of my life I've been sober, you know? And it's quite a deal, you know? And, you know, when we read chapter 5, it says cunning, baffling, and powerful. And when I read it, I always add patient. Because Bill Wilson was 3.5 years sober when he wrote that. I believe if he wrote that at 30 years, he would have added patient. Because, you know, I'm in here talking to you guys and we're laughing and all that, and my disease is in the parking lot doing push-ups, you know? See, because the thing is, you have two people. One, they're both 20 years old, both drinking. This guy gets sober, okay? This guy doesn't. 20 years later, this guy's been sober for 20 years. This guy has drank all 20 years. This guy picks up. Within a week or two, he is drinking at the same level as this guy is right now. You don't start back where you left off. The disease progresses whether we drink or not. And there's no scientific evidence to prove that. But I've been around these rooms for a long time. December 5th, it'll be 12,000 days I'll have. Okay? So, and what I've heard is, people come in, they go, it's exactly what you guys said. It played out, you know, they go out there and they come in with an ass full of arrows, you know, and, you know, it's like, that's what happened. I've never seen a relapse that was not therapeutic if you live through it. That's the trick. You know, you can pick up that drink, but there's no guarantee you're coming back. Or you're going to wake up face down in a cell with everybody going, you know what you did last night? You know? I mean, we got a guy right now, Gil, you know, killed those two people with his semi. You know, he's probably going to prison for the rest of his life. You know? we can make that decision on that first drink. After that, you know, but it's that Japanese saying, man takes a drink, drink takes a drink, drink takes the man, you know, is that the only thing we control is that first drink. Yeah. The locomotive kills you, not the caboose, you know. Well, it looks like my time's winding down. Appreciate you sitting there. Gave me a chance to listen to myself and go, oh, you know, because I'm not here for you guys. I'm here to listen to me because shit falls out of my mouth that I need to hear. You know, it's like writing. Stuff that comes out of the end of the pencil is not in my brain. You know, it's like you're writing and go, holy mackerel, where did that come from? You know, it's great stuff, you know. You know, I'll close with my sponsor, George. He used to say, you know, when you say goodbye, he'd always say, keep the faith. That was his thing. My thing is, God loves you, and I'm trying.
Let's give Peter another round of applause.